Hi, and welcome to the Games and Social Justice Public Lecture Series. My name is Biz Nidem, and I'll be your host for this afternoon's programming. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting in person on UBC's Point Grey campus, which is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. This programming today was very much inspired by my work in Indigenous studies, and in particular, Greg's work as it relates to issues of decolonization and analog game studies. It started me on a journey, and so this is really exciting to be coming back full circle, to be inviting you to UBC to talk about critical board game modification, mentioning some of the work you did with Catan, but also introducing us to strategies that will help my students and our listeners in thinking about how to break and remake board games. Today's programming is embedded in my fourth year Bachelor of Media Studies seminar and sponsored by the Popular Media for Social Change Research Excellence Cluster, otherwise known as the Pop Culture Cluster. The Pop Culture Cluster serves as an interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary hub for the evaluation of popular media and its impact in higher education and beyond, and seeks to identify the role of popular culture in illuminating and catalyzing social and political change. This particular presentation is also part of the Ziegler Lecture Series in the Department for Central, Eastern, and Northern European Studies, and we're grateful for their financial support. Alongside our speaker today, we have commissioned a local artist. Sarah draws a crowd to live draw the events and provide a graphic recording of our time together. Her drawings will be projected in real time when possible, and then will be compiled at the end of the series and hosted on our website as another form of documentation. So it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. Greg Loring Albright is an assistant professor of German, that's me, games, media, and culture at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. His dissertation analyzed analog games and their digital adaptations, and his research areas include analog games, fandom, and game design for social change. In addition to teaching and researching, he designs board games, including Ahoy from 2022, Block by Block Uprising from 2022, and Keep the Faith from 2024, and the official board game adaptation of The People's History of the United States, which is still forthcoming. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm thrilled that you're here to talk about your work and also help support our students in doing some of their work. So thank you so much. I'll leave it to you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. I don't know where my slides are. I'm so sorry. Oh, perfect. Wonderful. Hello. Yes, the title is here. Welcome, welcome. We are here to talk about critical board game modification, subtitled Changing Games to Change the World. I am Greg Loring Albright, as you can see. So before we really dig in and I ask you some questions, so be prepared, get ready to answer questions. I have to briefly set the scope, because which games and how are we going to change the world? So I'm going to be focusing on hobby board games. Is that a term that makes sense? Raise your hand if you know what hobby board games means. Do you know what board games means? Some people? Okay, good. So hobby board games basically is like a sort of niche, hyper-focused type of board game. So hobby board games tend to be authored. They have an accredited designer or author. They tend to require specific sets of pieces, right? So like playing a game with a deck of standard playing cards is not really a hobby board game. And they tend to be expensive, unfortunately. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the principles we're talking about apply to analog games writ large, right? We could talk about mass market games, we could talk about folk games, we could talk about tabletop role-playing games, all of which are out of scope, but kind of fit in some ways. And then, how are we changing the world? Because you know, there's a lot of ways to change the world. Specifically, I'm gonna talk about ways to embody new social relations, to build resilient, adaptable structures, to take power from those who misuse it, which is a quote from Bayard Rustin, one of my inspirations, and to create autonomy and care for all people. So if you don't want to do those things, this talk is probably not for you. But some of you have to be here for class, so you can't get up and leave. That's fine. Okay, so I asked, do you know what hobby board games are? What is a hobby board? What's a board game you have played? Just one or two of you shout them out. D&D, sure. A game, like what? Chess, sure. Monopoly, checkers. Say it again. Candyland. Yes, okay, good. So all of these are out of scope. None of these are hobby board games, right? D&D is a hobby game, sometimes played on a board, but it's in the tabletop role-playing lineage, which we don't have time to get into. Chess and checkers are folk games, right? They've evolved over millions of years. They don't have a dedicated author. You can play them with basically anything. Chess, asterisk, you got to be able to shape pieces. What was the last one? Candyland. Candyland's maybe the closest, but it doesn't fit for other reasons I won't talk about. Yes. Terraforming Mars is a classic hobby game. Yes. Expensive, requires specific pieces, known author. Yes, a great example of hobby board gaming. All right, so what we're going to talk about today is who I am, the problem with board games, what they can do to change the world, and then how you can start doing it. So who am I? I teach and research, as Biz said, at Harrisburg University of Science and Technology. I have my PhD from Drexel in Philadelphia, where I did my dissertation. Initially, it was going to be on board games and role-playing games played in person, and I proposed that, and then COVID happened. So now it's also about their digital adaptations. Some digital stuff will come up later. Who else am I? I'm a board game modder, right? This is the primary reason I'm here. I like to take games and make new things for them or with them or about them. Up here on the top left is top right is First Nations of Catan, which is my mod for the Settlers of Catan, a classic hobby board game. Who has played Catan here? Okay, good. So Catan, is this where I talk through it? Let me check my notes. No, later I'll talk through what I did. Anyway, in the journal Analog Game Studies, I published this modified rule set along with a sort of scholarly reflection on Catan. It was then adopted by the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery Coalition, which is a project through the Mennonites, which is sort of interesting. And they put out this one-page flyer with all the rules on it. There's also a haunt I wrote for Better Betrayal at House on the Hill, which is a very goofy game. I also design and publish games, right? So here's the games I've designed, Keep the Faith. My bio is wrong. It's not out in 24. It's not out yet. But the crowdfunding just finished. It's a storytelling game about religions evolving over 500 years. So that's what I do. Okay, so what is the problem with board games? There are lots of problems with board games. This first image, the black and white one, is from Mary Flanagan and Mikael Jakobsen's Playing Oppression, which is a really good book. It's open source from MIT Press, so you can read it for free. And it talks about how board games are sort of born out of imperial logics of needs to like map and reproduce and know and depict things that are like not yours, right? So here is buy empire goods from home and overseas, and you're like taking over places in the British Empire and buying their goods. Here's Catan, right? It's the Settlers of Catan. They've retitled it, which was a smart move on their part to get settler out of the title, right? But what I did in the Analog Game Studies piece is I said, okay, well, who's settling Catan, and what are they settling, and where are the indigenous people there? Some people got mad about this because people get mad on the internet, and also Klaus Teuber, the designer, has said he's talking about the settlement of Iceland, which was uninhabited, and so it's really fine, guys. It's not problematic at all. But from a North American context, if you have a game where you're doing a thing called settling, you can't not think about settler colonialism, right? And so I designed this mod to kind of unerase the indigenous, to say the Terra Nullius myth is bad, undergirded a genocide, shouldn't be replicated by playing this game, right? In Catan, you show up, you, the players, set up little settlements and roads, and you harvest wheat and sheep. And other people have asked things like, who grew the wheat? Who raised the sheep that you are now harvesting and using? And the game doesn't care and doesn't answer the question. So I proposed some rule changes to Catan to create a playable indigenous population that does their own resource gathering and also fights and tries to push the settlers out. And that's what was published that Biz ended up reading. And then I had to put down Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is both a classic, like important, good, well-designed board game and also a terrible example of the colonialist mindset. A big part of the game is staffing your plantations with workers, which are brown discs that come off of a ship. So it's not great. And there's a whole other stories about Puerto Rico, including some recent attempts to kind of deal with this history that had mixed results that I don't have time to go into. But look up Puerto Rico and Puerto Rico 1897 if you're interested in that story. Okay, so board games are problematic, right? From their kind of their past, of kind of imperialism, depicting, mapping, putting power over to their present, right? These two are not really the present. They're from the 90s. So these are kind of like the like ur texts of hobby board gaming. If someone's a big hobby board gamer, you will often hear them say, and they're my age, right? You'll often hear them say like, oh yeah, Catan and Puerto Rico were how I got into the hobby. And it's like, oh no, look what you were doing. So board games are problematic. They're also problematic for other reasons, right? Plenty of people have talked about these depictions and these mechanical problems, but board games are also trouble because they require a lot of their players, right? They require literacy in a high degree, right? You often have to read and comprehend complex sentences. Some of my favorite board game friends to play games with are lawyers. They require a lot of attention, right? You have to be able to sit and focus for a few hours at a time, which is a problem for me as a parent of young children. You need to have time to sit down and play, which means you're not, you know, working your second job or, you know, driving Uber or whatever. You need to have money to buy the games or pay to play at a board game cafe. And you need to have, as I put by demonstrating with this picture, space to store them, right? They're huge. This picture on the right here is someone's check out my collection picture online. I'm not really trying to like rag on this person too hard. They just like posted on Reddit about their board games they like, but it was the biggest shelves I could find. I'm sure there are more out there somewhere, but like, look at that. Like, it's so many. And you can't just like live in a tiny apartment and have that collection, right? It's not gonna happen, or it has to like take over your life. And then that's my collection over there. And these games are pretty big, like Oath, that game with the kind of blue guy and the white text is like this wide. So these are not small, right? They require a lot of their players, literacy, attention, time, money, space, which is not inherently bad, right? It's okay to have hobbies. It's good to do things that require time and attention. But to do those things means you have some level of privilege, and that often goes unrecognized in the board game hobby. And why I'm talking about it is that it's like it's inherent to the form, right? If I'm going to say, oh, I want to change the world, what form should I use? This is a stumbling block, right? This is a form that is kind of already gated off in a lot of ways. So should we even try to use board games to make the world a better place? They are kind of already flawed, right? One way you could do it, this was animated due to technical things. I couldn't animate it. This is a surprise where I'm like going to say this thing, games create empathy, and then reject it. But now you know the surprise. So some people have said games create empathy. I don't actually love this position or idea. I think it's often overstated. I think it's too easy. These scholars agree with me. There's like a common thread in queer studies in particular. It's kind of like anti-empathy, not anti-empathy as like a thing you do as a person, but anti-empathy as a thing that is produced by representational media. Once again, I don't have time to go into the whole thing, but basically this is a kind of troubled statement, right? This, if you want to change the world with games, I think you could do better than trying to create empathy with games. You can create empathy with other things like loving people. Games gather people together in person. This I like, this is good, right? To play a board game, you literally have to be around a table or a bed or the floor with other people in your house. Asterisk, you could do it online, right? There are ways to play board games online, board game arena, tabletop simulator, et cetera. Some of those you do still have to gather, right? Like on a voice or a video call. And that's kind of a kind of gathering. Some of them you can play asynchronously where it's like, I take a turn, pings the next person, they take a turn, pings the next person. So that's not really what I'm talking about. But in general, right, in their sort of like prototypical example form, a board game is something you do around a table with other people. And I think that's one of their strengths. And then lastly, games make systems legible. I'm drawing very heavily on this book, Cardboard Ghosts by Amabel Holland. Really great book. Amabel's a games designer who makes all kinds of weird complimentary games. And this book basically says, because to play a board game, you have to understand its rules, then you understand what the board game is modeling, right? If I make a game about, getting into college, right? And like balancing your extracurriculars and your grades and your friends and your application letters, and someone who has not gotten into college plays that game, they can understand the system, right? I'm saying something different from they can empathize with someone who has applied to college. I'm saying they can think about, oh, now I know what it means to balance spending time at soccer practice versus spending time studying for math. And video games can model systems too, but part of what Amabel says in this book is like, you have to do it, right? A computer doesn't move the pieces for you. You have to say, oh shoot, I went to soccer practice, so I increase my extracurriculars by 3. or whatever. You do that, or someone else at the table sitting with you does that. And so now you understand the system. Maybe not fully, maybe not correctly, right? Maybe the designer has modeled the system improperly, but at least board games can do that. If you could design a game that modeled the system well, then people who played the game would understand the system. I like this a lot. Excuse me. And then finally, board games afford modding and making, right? By this same principle, because they're analog, because you set them on the table, you don't need to learn software to mod them, right? I have a student who mods Doom levels, and she's very cool and she's very good at it. And she showed me the modding program, and I was like, I don't know. I'm not going anywhere near that, right? But if you set a board game in front of me, I can say, oh, what if we put that piece over here next time? Or what if we drew two cards instead of one? Right? Board games inherently afford this because they are physically operable. All of the computational level occurs with physical objects that someone can just grab and mess with. You may have enacted a house rule in Uno or put the free parking money in Monopoly, right? This is an example of this. Don't forget TTRPGs. I always forget TTRPGs, so I put that there. They also are really good at this, right? Playing a tabletop role-playing game, GMing in particular, is a kind of game design, right? You are setting up systems for your players to encounter, or if you're in like a GM-less game, you are collaboratively saying, here's what we want to represent, and here's how we'll use the rules of this game to represent it. So that's another strength. So why should you use board games to try and change the world? Because gathering people together, talking about systems, and modding and making are good for the world. So that's the end of the theory. My students love when I say that. They're like, yes, now we're going to get to do something. How can we start? I include here the anarchist aphorism, simply begin. How should you do something? You should just do it. What if I don't know how to do it? You'll learn by doing it. What if I'm bad at it? It's okay to be bad at things. No one's going to judge you. You should just do it. You should represent the hidden, right? So this is the Catan example, right? The indigenous had been hidden, and I wanted to make them appear and say, oh, look, this was erased from the world. So you can do that with board games. You can incentivize non-domination. I haven't talked a lot about this, but a lot of board games are about winning. This is a fairly like obvious thing to say, right? People are like, yes, of course, right? Why do you need to say this out loud? But there are ways to make games that aren't about winning or that are about winning altogether. In fact, right, the D&D example came up. How do you win D&D, right? You can't. You could say, I won the campaign by, you know, killing Strahd or whatever. But there's a different thing at play. You don't play D&D to win, per se. There are some people, Zoe Allred and the people at Lunar Punk Games are doing a lot of really interesting writing right now about, what do they call them? Not victorless, like non-ranked or non-hierarchical game design, where you play games in a way that you are trying to accomplish a goal and other people are trying to accomplish a goal, and those goals may or may not be at odds with one another, and they may or may not be ranked in terms of difficulty or priority or whatever. Very interesting stuff. I'm thinking a lot about this. I'm working on a game that has that model right now. And then lastly, new distribution models, right? To deal with the space problem. This is something that at least US-based game designers are thinking a lot about right now with tariffs and global trade being up in the air basically since COVID, right? Is like, these big games are expensive to make and ship, and they're only getting more expensive to make and ship. How can we create games that are smaller, that are distributable digitally, that are like basically just paper? So any of these three things are good ways to intervene in the board game space. How do you do it? Well, you find a game that you like, and it should be a game you like because you're gonna spend a lot of time with it. You shouldn't hate mod a board game because you'll either come to love it or you'll stop doing it. That has a problem, right? So again, Catan. I liked playing Catan. I felt weird about it, and so I wanted to change it. Find a game you like that has a problem. Isolate the problem. The Catan replicates the Terra Nullius myth. I feel bad about that. I want to change that. Let's make the invisible visible. Isolate the problem, brainstorm solutions, gather people to try it, put it on the table, say, let's play it, take their feedback, change the design, gather people to try it, take their feedback, change the design, gather people to try it, change it, et cetera, et cetera, right? This is the iterative loop. This is what game design is. When I say take their feedback, sometimes people say, okay, that means everything a playtester says to me, I need to do. No, that's wrong. Take their feedback means, you could have a whole talk on this, and there's my whole books on this, right? But basically, you need to understand your design intent. You need to understand what the problem is that you're trying to solve and how you're going to solve it, so that when people say, oh, you should change it, you can say, thank you for your feedback, and then ignore them because they've suggested something that is not actually in line with your design goals, right? Or maybe they suggested something great and you're like, yes, I will change that. This happened to me recently, right? But you have to be able to receive feedback in order to act on it or discard it. Once you're doing this, you're a game designer. So how should you get started? Start with what you know, right? Again, I modded Catan, not because I have an indigenous background, right? I'm a white guy, but I started with what I knew, which was my discomfort with the cultural narrative that this game was perpetuating. And I said, let me start from there, right? Start with what you know, start small. My intent with Catan was to take the pieces in the game box and not have to add anything, because I know if people are gonna start doing something, they wanna just get it off the box and start doing it. I broke that rule one time. There's one piece you have to add, but it can be literally anything as long as it fits on the Catan board. So start small, don't remake the entire system, right? Pick a part of the game and intervene in it. Start with people you know. It's hard to show your stuff to people you don't know, so show it to your friends and family. And start soon, because you're gonna forget that this talk happened. You're gonna get busy with stuff. In fact, we're going to start very soon. I also have a reading list here. Cardboard Ghost was up there. I showed an image from Playing Oppression. Repairing Play, I didn't actually mention this book. I mentioned it in an earlier version of this talk, but I wanted to leave it here because it's great. It's also an open access book from MIT Press. Aaron Trammell, who's a great scholar of games and play, talks about who gets to play and who gets played with, right? In terms of like the subject and the object, thinking about like the subaltern, race, indigeneity, et cetera, et cetera. It's a really good book. And then these two are not games books, but they're also wonderful. So trying something new, working outside the profit motive, criticizing the status quo are good for the world. And you can do those things using board games as your medium. Any questions? I guess I should read this aloud. I saw this and it made me laugh, so I had to put it in here. Me shaking you violently. You need to create. Art is expression. Perfection is just a concept. Mistakes are learning endeavors. I need you to create. That's this talk in one tweet. And I guess we're not doing questions because we're going to workshop. So I will. If you have a burning question to ask me, you can. Great. Let's get started. Should I leave this? Okay. So online folks, we are going to pivot to a workshop. I'm looking at the computer, but you're not in there. I don't know where the camera is. Somewhere. Hello, online folks. We're going to do a hands-on workshop. We will stop the recording, but we'll leave the Zoom on if you want to participate at home. But you won't really get the full deal because we're like here in the room with games and paper and stuff. So you can also leave if you want to. Thank you for coming. Thank you.